From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's Earth Day, and on today's Fresh Air, we look at the movement to protect Africa's wildlife. Journalist Raymond Bonner lived in Kenya for 4 years. In his new book, he criticizes Western conservation groups for placing the needs of African animals over the needs of African people. We'll also talk with Jeanette Hemley of the World Wildlife Fund, the world's largest conservation group. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet talks with one of rock music's most ardent environmentalists, Peter Garrett, lead singer of the Australian band Midnight Oil. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie This Boy's Life, starring Robert De Niro and Ellen Barkin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton dedicated the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum today with a warning that the same kind of persecution exists in the world today. The museum chronicles the Nazi murder of millions of Jews and other persecution victims during World War II. Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel also spoke at the ceremony, reminding his listeners that the world had ignored evidence that the Nazis were running death camps. He turned to President Clinton with an appeal that something be done to stop the bloodshed in Bosnia. President Clinton cited the Serbian practice of so-called ethnic cleansing in Bosnia as evidence that the evils that produced the Holocaust still exist. German Chancellor Helmut Kohl says the dedication of the memorial renews painful memories for Germans and the victims of Nazi persecution. Lynn Weil has more from Bonn.
Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel represented his country at the ceremonies in Washington. But at a news conference, Kohl was asked his opinion of the Holocaust Museum. The Chancellor has never lived down the speech he made a few years ago when he said his generation was lucky to have been born too late to answer for the Nazis' actions. On the question of whether Germany, too, should have a Holocaust museum, Kohl offered only a terse comment. He said, I think we've made our contribution to the memory of these horrors in a dignified way by preserving the concentration camps in Germany as a commemoration to the dead. President Richard von Weizsäcker, often quoted as the voice of the German conscience, sent a letter to the directors of the Holocaust Memorial emphasizing the importance of a trusting relationship between Germany and America. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil in Bonn.
Authorities in Ohio say they've found another body in the prison that was taken over by inmates for 11 days. Officials say the discovery means everyone in the facility has been accounted for. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
The bodies of two more inmates were discovered today as officials looked through cell block L, where rebel inmates had barricaded themselves since Easter Sunday. The rebels gave up last night under the glare of TV lights as live cameras beamed the surrender across the state. The death toll in this prison takeover now stands at 10, 9 inmates and 1 guard. 7 other guards who had been held hostage were freed by their captors. While the bad news of the 2 additional deaths was announced, there was some good news. Authorities said they have now accounted for every one of the Lucasville inmates. That should put an end to news reports, which cited unnamed sources claiming that dozens of bodies were piled up inside the prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Cohen reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 10 points to close at 3,429. Declines led advances. This is NPR News. Croatian President Franjo Tudjman appealed today for a halt to the fighting between Muslims and ethnic Croats in Bosnia. Speaking from Washington, where he attended the dedication of the Holocaust Museum, Tudjman blamed the fighting between the former allies on what he called Serbian provocations and disinformation. Tudjman said that on Saturday, he and Bosnian Croat leader Mate Boban will meet with Bosnia's Muslim president. Government scientists suspect that man-made chemicals and dust from a volcanic explosion combined to temporarily thin the ozone shield over North America and Europe. In an article in the current issue of Science, they report that global ozone levels have hit a record low. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
Scientists working for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration say satellite measurements show that global stratospheric ozone levels fell faster than expected last winter, especially in the skies above North America and Europe. They say the 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines may have compounded ozone problems wrought by man-made chemicals. Many of these chemicals are being phased out, but they haven't yet left the atmosphere. Stratospheric ozone blocks ultraviolet sunlight, which can cause cancer, but NASA scientists note that their measurements were recorded in the winter when relatively little ultraviolet light reaches the Earth. Northern ozone levels may return to something close to normal levels in the summer when exposure risks are highest. In Washington, I'm John Nielsen.
Federal health officials say that American doctors are delivering too many babies by cesarean section. The Centers for Disease Control says that in 1991, U.S. doctors performed 349,000 unnecessary cesareans at a cost of more than $1 billion. The report says cesareans were performed most often in for-profit hospitals. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even those of us who have never set foot on the continent of Africa recognize the importance of protecting its wildlife from extinction. The question is, how do we do it? We'll hear a couple of different answers to that question on this Earth Day. Journalist Raymond Bonner makes the case that Western wildlife conservation groups are practicing eco-colonialism by projecting Western attitudes onto African cultures. After living in Kenya for 4 years, Bonner has completed his book At the Hand of Man, Peril and Hope for Africa's Wildlife. Bonner is a former foreign correspondent for the New York Times and is the author of books criticizing American policy toward El Salvador and the Philippines. In 1989, the member nations of the Convention of International Trade in Endangered Species, known by the acronym CITES, declared the elephant endangered and banned all trade in ivory. Although Bonner opposes the ban now, he supported it when he moved to Africa. I asked him why he had supported it.
Why? I suppose I did for the same reason most Americans did, most Westerners did, who'd never spent any time in Africa. A love for the animals, a caring, a desire to save them, thinking they're extraordinary and we really have to save the elephants, and that it seemed horrible to see them killed for their tusks. One of the very first weekends I was in Africa, we went on a safari and we went up to near where George Adamson lived, who was the lion man, of course, and we went out and we saw these poached elephants, and I was sickened. I mean, there they'd been slaughtered, their tusks had been cut off, and I thought we have to have an ivory ban. Have to stop ivory trading. I think it was a knee-jerk, typical knee-jerk, soft-hearted liberal approach. But the longer I was there, the more I began to realize that it was not an issue that was so simple. It was not really black and white. The elephants do cause damage to people, like this letter I read from this woman. I met more and more people whose property was damaged by elephants, and I began to realize that banning ivory was not going to save the elephant. And I saw programs in other countries that are working, positive programs like in Zimbabwe, like in Namibia, where they are protecting against poaching, and they were doing it before there was an ivory ban.
Do you support ivory trading now?
With a heavy heart, I think, it's not a very comfortable thought that we're going to commercialize elephants, if you will, that we're going to make money from selling ivory. It's not a very pleasant thought, but neither is the poverty of Africa a very pleasant thought. And that a continent that has very few resources, one of the resources is wildlife, and the question is, how do you give that wildlife an economic value so that people have an incentive to save it? Now, that might not be a very nice way to put it, but if you're a conservationist and we want to save the wildlife, whether it's the rhinoceros, the elephant, the lion, whatever, we're going to have to come up with new approaches. And one way to save the wildlife is to give it an economic value. I can tell you in Zimbabwe, where they have programs where the local people, the people who live in the rural areas, the people who are affected by the wildlife, whose lives are affected on a daily basis by the wildlife, they are now making money from the wildlife. They have a real incentive. They turn in poachers. Look, if an elephant, let's say an elephant, you're going to make money from selling the ivory from 3% of your elephant population. 3% of the elephant population means the population is going to remain stable. It's not going to be threatened. And let's say that brings in, the amount of money that brings in to some rural villages is an extraordinary amount of money for that rural village. And those people are then going to say, wait a minute, we're not going to allow poachers to come in here and take off our elephants. That's like robbing our bank. Those elephants are our assets. We're not going to let poachers kill them.
But wouldn't ivory hunters kill even more elephants than poachers would, endangering the species even more?
No. No, it's controlled. For example, in Zimbabwe, they would allow an offtake, what they call an offtake, of 3% of the population. Sure, there's going to be crooks, but you've got crooks out there robbing banks, too. That doesn't mean we shut down banks and don't have banks. You have effective law enforcement. The only place you needed an ivory ban, the only place poaching was out of hand, by the way, was in Kenya and Tanzania. And why? Because of corruption and mismanagement. The ivory ban probably was needed in Kenya and Tanzania, but was needed because of corruption and mismanagement. And rather than address those long-range problems, we took the easy solution, which was to impose a total ban on ivory. The elephant isn't threatened in Zimbabwe. There's 50,000 elephants in Zimbabwe, a country the size of California, by the way. Can you imagine 50,000 grizzly bears in California? 50,000 elephants in Zimbabwe, which is more than they had 10 years ago. Probably 60,000 elephants in Botswana, which is more than they had 10 years ago. Poaching isn't a problem there. The way to deal with poaching is effective law enforcement.
So do you think that the Western approach to conservation is effectively punishing Africans?
Yes, of course it's punishing Africans. It's saying, basically the Western approach to conservation in Africa is saying this: we consider the animals and the land to be a world heritage, but you're going to pay the cost of protecting it, because the West isn't putting in the money to protect these places, directly or indirectly. It's not allowing the Africans to make money off the wildlife, to receive benefits from the wildlife, so they're the ones who are having to pay the cost. It's the cost in damaged property, in damage to their crops, in loss of life.
Well, you mentioned tourism and hunting, and you say that Westerners have always put a lot of stake in tourism, but you're actually thinking a lot about hunting as a way to help the conservation of wildlife, which sounds like a contradiction, but obviously you don't think it is. So explain how hunting could help preservation of wildlife.
Again, it does sound like a contradiction, and again, it's not something I feel very comfortable about. I was forced to examine a lot of my preconceptions mm-hmm. about wildlife and about conservation. I really was while I was in Africa. I'm not a hunter. It's not too strong to say I deplore hunting. I literally have never picked up a rifle and shot an animal. I grew up in Minnesota, but my father never considered it was a rite of passage to hunt. All my friends were hunters, but I never went hunting, and I never felt I lost anything because of it. I thought hunters were, frankly, a lower form of the species and probably not worth saving from extinction. But the longer I was in Africa, I began to have to think, now, what do we want? What are we after? We're after trying to save the wildlife, to make sure that the rhino and the elephant, the lion, the giraffe, doesn't go extinct. And hunting may be the best form of conservation, because hunters, they bring in a lot more money than tourists does. A hunting safari brings in $50,000, let's say, per person. You can go on a photographic safari for about $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000. The head of the wildlife department in Tanzania once told me, he said, I figure one hunter is worth 100 non-hunters. Again, it's not a very comfortable thought, but I think we're going to have to examine and deal with and confront some of our preconceptions about conservation if we're truly going to save the wildlife. And if you ask conservationists seriously and privately, when they don't have to face what they know is popular public opinion, they'll tell you these things. They didn't think the ivory ban was a good idea. You couldn't find one conservationist in Africa when the ivory ban was proposed who thought it was a good idea. I was researching my book then, starting it, so I was interviewing these people long before the idea became so popular in the West. They were all opposed to it. And if you talk to them, they'll tell you privately they think hunting is a good idea. Even there's a guy I talk about in the book, Esmond Bradley Martin, who has probably led the movement to save the rhino. I mean, internationally, he's the person most responsible for saving the rhino. He's done incredible work. I mean, Esmond Bradley Martin has said if you could sell a rhino for $50,000, a hunting license, it might be worth it, because then we could plow the money back into conservation. It's a horrible thought, but it's even a worse thought that these animals might disappear.
My guest is journalist Raymond Bonner. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ray Bonner, author of the new book, At the Hand of Man, Peril and Hope for Africa's Wildlife. You've been critical of some conservation groups for the way they raised money through the ban on ivory trading. Can you elaborate on some of your criticisms of that?
Sure. It's in some ways quite simple. There was not, as I said earlier, there was not a single conservation at the time the ban was proposed that thought it was a good idea. And then public emotion, the groundswell of public emotion and the amount of money that came in for being in favor of the ivory ban was so great that they switched their positions. Take the World Wildlife Fund, which is the largest wildlife conservation organization in the world. At WWF-US, the U.S. chapter of the World Wildlife Fund, all the conservationists who had any experience in Africa were opposed to the ban, and the fundraisers were in favor of it. And they let public emotion and fundraising considerations overcome good science and good conservation. The African Wildlife Foundation, which was one of the leaders in the movement to ban ivory, when it was proposed to them in early 1988, they didn't even want a total ban. They were the ones that first called for a boycott on buying ivory, a voluntary consumer boycott. They didn't want people to buy ivory, which was fine. But I have to tell you, even the Africans didn't like that. And that's something we can come back to. I mean, the Africans never wanted an ivory ban. The majority of the African countries, with a majority of the continent's elephants, opposed an ivory ban to the bitter end. So this was something that was imposed by Western conservation values.
You've talked a little bit about the conflicts between development and conservation in Africa. Your book also deals with conflicts between traditional conservationists and animal rights activists. What are the fundamental differences between those two groups?
The fundamental difference is the animal rights groups want to save every single animal, and the more traditional conservationists want to save ecosystems. I remember talking to a conservationist in Zimbabwe who worked for the World Wildlife Fund. He said, that's the fundamental difference between us. They want to save every single animal, and we realize you can't, if you want to save ecosystems, you can't save every animal. Take the elephant, for example. There are too many elephants in Amboseli Park in Kenya. It's 700 or 800, which isn't very many, but it's a very small park. If you go through Amboseli, it looks like, tourists sometimes refer to it as a tree holocaust. It looks like somebody's gone through with a flamethrower. The trees are destroyed. They're dead because of elephants. You know, elephants either knock over saplings or they pull up little bigger trees or they rub their tusks against trees and the trees die. And because the trees have died, the habitat is gone for a lot of other species. You see hardly any giraffe, hardly any reed buck, hardly any monkeys in Amboseli anymore because the elephants have destroyed their habitat. So it's an ecosystem thing. You can't have all the elephants that you want and also have other animals as well. And the animal rights people tend not to see this. And also the thing is, they tend to focus only on animals without thinking about people. I mean, the number of groups after the ivory ban that was put into effect and said, including the African Wildlife Foundation, that said victory for the elephants. Well, victory for the elephants, perhaps, but as I say in the book, what about the people of Africa? Was it a victory for them? No, it was a defeat for them. If you ask Africans, they considered that a defeat.
Have you been rethinking your stand on conservation in the United States?
No, I don't think it's, well, I hope I'm always thinking, but I mean, I don't, to say that we should allow, let's say, for example, trading in ivory or allow sustainable utilization, the utilization of wildlife in Africa, is not the same as to say that we should sacrifice the spotted owl to the timber industry. The difference is this. In America, we already have, obviously, the highest standard of living in the world. And when we cut down more trees or dam more rivers or take away the habitat of more species, we're doing it to have an even higher standard of living so that we can have more and bigger houses or more furniture from timber, or we dam rivers so that we can have more hydroelectric power so that we can run more air conditioners and more refrigerators and more electronic gear. So in America, we're making sacrifices of the environment for an even higher standard of living. In Africa, some sacrifices are going to have to be made of the wildlife. It's a matter of survival so that they have a dignified standard of living.
In your acknowledgments, you thank your agent for not letting you quit writing this book. What was making you consider quitting?
It was tough. It was a hard book to write. Different, I suppose, than the other books I've written. Let's face it, Terry, it's easier to criticize governments than it is to criticize non-governmental organizations that are considered to be on the side of the angels. So, I mean, it was tough. It was a harder book to write, perhaps because the subject was a new one for me, and it wasn't just straight government policy. I mean, I tried to capture some of the majesty, the beauty of Africa, the feel of Africa, and places like the Serengeti, and again, you know, the chapter in the book about the Serengeti and what's happened to the Maasai. I mean, there's another classic situation. I mean, go to the Serengeti and Ngorongoro. I mean, they are two of the most staggering places in the world. They are really spiritually, religiously, in any way you want, moving. You stand in the bowl of Ngorongoro, this 100-mile, square-mile bowl. I mean, it's the size of Manhattan. Natural zoo. Absolute beauty. The Serengeti, a place the size of Connecticut. It's just moving to be in there and to see the wildlife and nothing else for miles. And I mean, sometimes, as I say, it's the size of Connecticut, and you swear you could see from New Haven to Hartford. I mean, it's so wide open. But look, those are great parks, and we love to go there, and Westerners go there. The Maasai lost their land to make those parks. And they are suffering. I mean, what the Maasai are going through now, I mean, they're living in absolute poverty. They're not getting any benefits. They got tossed off the lands back in the 1950s to make these parks pristine. What are the Maasai getting out of it? You know, as I call that chapter, whose heritage is it? Is it ours? Is it the world? Or does it belong to the people of Africa?
Raymond Bonner is the author of At the Hand of Man, Peril and Hope for Africa's Wildlife. The World Wildlife Fund is the world's largest conservation organization. We called Jeanette Hemley, director of the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Program. She's read Bonner's book and says he's overlooked some fundamental points.
Some of those relate to the very reasons elephants are now recovering, and that is because the ivory trade ban that he argues was not a good idea has actually helped save elephants. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a conservationist anywhere in the world who would not agree with that today.
Let me get to a couple of the main points he makes in his book and that he made in our interview. He says that a lot of Western-based conservation groups aren't taking into account the economic needs and the economic development of African people. Do you agree with that?
No, I disagree completely. In fact, if there's one thing that World Wildlife has learned during its 30 years of global conservation efforts is that conservation will not be successful unless you incorporate and address human needs. We are doing that throughout Africa, throughout Asia, Latin America, wherever we work. In fact, we launched a program in 1985 called Wildlands and Human Needs, which specifically is set out to address combining sustainable development with resource protection. And that was certainly a very big factor in our discussions and concern over the survival of the elephant and the discussion over the ivory trade ban and during that debate.
I know Bonner thinks that there needs to be an economic incentive for African people to practice wildlife conservation. He says hungry Africans aren't going to tolerate the damage elephants wreak if they don't get some economic benefit from the animal. And that's one of the reasons why he opposes the ban on ivory trading, because ivory trading gives a reason for preservation. You're making money from the elephants.
Well, I think it's important to look at the facts that surrounded this whole issue in the mid and late 80s when there was a virtual crisis going on in Africa. What was going on is that elephants were declining in rapid numbers throughout the 1980s. They were being killed on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 per week. 90% of the ivory that was leaving Africa was from illegal sources. The argument and the point about economic incentive to conserve wildlife and protect natural resources is something we certainly agree with completely. But when you look at the particular situation surrounding the African elephant and that debate, local people were not benefiting overall from the ivory trade. And that's what we and the countries that debated this issue through the International Trade Convention called CITES, which ultimately did impose the ivory trade ban in 1989, decided.
Several wildlife conservation groups waged big campaigns to save the elephants of Africa. And the campaign to save the elephants included fundraising campaigns to help the wildlife groups save the elephants. Ray Bonner says that wildlife groups exaggerated the threat of elephant extinction because it was an effective tool to raise money.
Well, elephants were certainly part of our fundraising agenda here at World Wildlife Fund, but simply because there was a conservation imperative. As I said, there was a major crisis going on in Africa. But what he ignores is the fact that here at World Wildlife Fund, I mean, our fundraisers made it clear that they would adopt whatever approach the program and field experts said was most appropriate. And overall, another fact that Raymond Bonner ignores is that in the late 80s, between 1987 and 1990 here at World Wildlife Fund, less than 4% of World Wildlife Fund's membership income came from fundraising appeals focusing on elephants. I mean, we have a very big agenda. There are endangered species crises all over the world, ranging from the destruction of the Amazon rainforest to the protection of the snow leopards in Nepal and in the Himalayas. Elephants were part of that indeed, but again, they were only a small part of our overall agenda, but that part of the agenda was important because elephants were dropping. As I said, their numbers were declining at rates up to 2,000 animals being poached per week, and so that was a virtual crisis.
What about the countries that still have a lot of elephants, or perhaps even an overpopulation of elephants? Does it make sense to support the ivory trade in countries that still have very large populations of elephants? You know, we're decreasing populations of elephants isn't a problem.
Well, that is certainly one of the issues that was discussed and reviewed during the debate. We've looked long and hard at it. And I think the complication is that the trade control structure that would be developed to ensure that no illegal ivory would leak into trade if you did allow some trade from countries that do have large numbers of elephants is simply not there yet. And one of the problems that complicated the whole elephant-ivory trade issue during the 1980s that became very clear to us after a lot of analyses of trade data and poaching data is there was a tremendous amount of laundering of ivory going on in the sense that elephant ivory taken in a country where the elephant is completely protected was shipped through countries that have a more open export policy and laundered through illegally. Now, if there were a way that you could develop a system that would ensure that wouldn't happen, I think we'd be, you know, on a whole different discussion now. But that has not yet happened, and until it happens through CITES, I think we really must hold the ivory trade moratorium in place to ensure that elephants as a whole are protected throughout Africa.
Jeanette Hemley directs the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Program of the World Wildlife Fund. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the lead singer of one of the bands headlining the Earth Day concert in Washington, D.C., Peter Garrett of the Australian band Midnight Oil. He's serious about his music and his politics. He even ran for the Senate in Australia. He's played lots of the standard rock venues, but he's also performed for Aboriginals in the Australian outback, and he played a concert on 6th Avenue in New York in front of the Exxon building to protest the Alaskan oil spill. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, This Boy's Life, starring Ellen Barkin and Robert De Niro. It's based on a memoir by Tobias Wolff. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton and the leaders of a dozen nations gathered in Washington today to dedicate the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. The museum chronicles the systematic killing of 6 million Jews and others during the Second World War. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
More than 10,000 people braved an unseasonably cold drizzle for today's ceremony. Among them were leaders from 12 nations, including Chaim Herzog, president of Israel. Elie Wiesel, Nobel laureate and a concentration camp survivor, drew a parallel to current events. He urged President Clinton to stop the bloodshed in the former Yugoslavia. And when Croatian President Franjo Tudjman was introduced, there were some muffled boos from the audience. Tudjman has called Israelis Judeo-Nazis for their treatment of Palestinians, and he said that the estimate of 6 million Jews killed during the Holocaust is inflated. The White House defended the invitation, pointing out that Tudjman is a democratically elected leader. The Holocaust Museum was built at a cost of $168 million, all of it from private donations. It opens to the public on Monday. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
Democratic congressional leaders have introduced a measure on Capitol Hill that would end normal trade relations with China unless there are major changes in human rights in that nation, weapons dealing, and trade practices. The bill is similar to ones approved in Congress in the past, but vetoed by then-President Bush. Senate Democratic Leader George Mitchell says it's hoped the measure won't be necessary, but that it is intended mainly as leverage for President Clinton in dealing with China. Also on Capitol Hill, the House today approved $4 billion for extended unemployment benefits. The vote came on a day after the Senate abandoned efforts to approve a broader economic stimulus package. NPR's Brian Nader reports.
Today's vote came after Democrats blasted Senate Republicans for their filibuster, which blocked the president's $16 billion stimulus package. House Democratic leader Richard Gephardt promised Democrats have not given up their efforts to get a jobs bill approved.
We will continue to fight to allow the American people to get what they asked for in November of 1992, and that is at least the consideration of a new program to invest in this economy.
House Republicans, meanwhile, praised their Senate colleagues for standing up to the administration and killing a bill they said was full of wasteful spending that would add to the deficit but do little to put people to work. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Former presidential candidate Ross Perot has told Congress that it needs to turn down the North American Free Trade Agreement. The agreement worked out by the Bush administration would phase out tariffs and other trade barriers among the United States, Canada, and Mexico. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 10 points to close at 3,429. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, Muslim and Croatian forces battle for land in central Bosnia today, and UN peacekeepers say that they have been unable to stop the fighting. In the eastern part of the country, UN officials say a ceasefire is holding, but the struggle for control of towns and villages in central Bosnia is posing a new threat to a UN-sponsored peace plan signed by Muslim and Croatian leaders but turned down by Serbian factions. Earlier, Croatian and Muslim army commanders promised to pull back their forces. A jury in Montgomery, Alabama, has found Governor Guy Hunt guilty of a felony ethics violation. The verdict means that Hunt is no longer governor of Alabama. Alan Collins of member station WUAL reports from Montgomery.
It took the jury less than 2 hours to decide Governor Hunt had used his office for personal gain. Hunt was accused of diverting $200,000 from his 1987 inauguration into his private bank accounts. Hunt remained unemotional as the verdict was read. His wife Helen bowed her head. Later, the former governor said he was shocked at the verdict but plans an appeal. Lieutenant Governor Jim Folsom Jr. will automatically become governor of Alabama. This is the first time a sitting governor of the state has been removed from office because of a criminal court decision. Hunt was Alabama's first Republican governor in 112 years. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Collins in Montgomery.
Germany's central bank has lowered interest rates from 7.5% to 7.25%. The discount rate is the bank's cheapest rate for loans to commercial banks. The step is seen as another effort to give a push to the nation's slowing economy. For more than a year now, the bank has been under pressure to ease its monetary policy and help encourage domestic and international economic growth. But the Central Bank of Germany has only gradually lowered its key interest rates. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There's a big Earth Day concert in Washington tonight. On the bill is the Australian rock group Midnight Oil. They're a band that refuses to compromise their values. They've never accepted corporate sponsorship, and they used to go so far as putting gaffer tape over the company names on their amps. The Oils, as they're called, have recorded songs about nuclear disarmament, asbestos mining, and after the wreck of the Exxon Valdez, they did an impromptu concert on Manhattan's 6th Avenue in front of Exxon headquarters. In 1986, they were invited to perform for the Aborigines in the Australian outback. They've since written many songs based on that experience. Before we meet lead singer Peter Garrett, let's hear a new one from their latest album, Earth and Sun and Moon. This is about one of the last Tasmanian Aborigines, a woman named Truganini.
The backbone of this country is broken. The land is cracked and the land is sore. Farmers are hanging on by their fingertips. We're cursed and stumbled across that shore.
Midnight Oil's lead singer, Peter Garrett, spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. He told her about their tour through the Australian outback.
I have an abiding memory because there's no noise out there except the noise of nature. And there's no real signs of what we would see as being quite typical 1980s, 1990s life. I mean, there are no supermarkets, there are no covered roads, there are no phone boxes. There is trash, but not trash in the way that we would see it. There are wrecks of cars and humpy buildings. And, of course, there's never been a noise as loud as even a small-time rock band in the desert at night when the wind has stopped and you can hear the sound of a lizard from, you know, half a mile away scraping its stomach across a rock. You can imagine when we started to play what the noise was like. And in the furthest area of remoteness, which is where the Pintabee tribe are, and they were a tribe that were in the Guinness Book of Records in 1986 or 87 as being the poorest people on the planet. They were the ones that adopted us into their family. And the night that we played in a huge, open, bare red rock plain, about as far imaginable away from anything as imaginable, I remember we've played the first three or four chords and about 20 of the older women sitting up the back went fleeing back into their humpies with their hands over their heads. So, I mean, you know, they laughed when I danced and we did sort of semi-workshops and had meetings during the day so that we could get an understanding of what was going on and actually found that sitting around the campfire at night telling stories and drinking cups of tea and just playing guitar and playing Rolling Stones records was and old country songs was often quite much more successful in the show.
When you went back to Sydney, you wrote some songs based on the experience of being in the outback, and these songs ended up on your album Diesel and Dust. I'd like to play a song off that record. What song do you feel best captures what you got from that experience?
Well, there are a couple on the album, but I think I would take a song like Warrakoona.
What can you tell us about this song, Warrakoona?
Warrakern is a little town just across the border between South Australia and Western Australia. It's near an area where the British actually did nuclear testing in Australia in the 50s. It's a town where you have to drive for at least 11 or 12 hours to actually arrive there. And we came out to play to them. They weren't expecting us to play because we had no permissions to go into those particular areas. And we ran into a friend who was working as a lawyer for Aboriginal people there, who suggested that we ought to play in Western Australia. We had a day to get there. We arrived and we played a concert to eight people, a camel and about seven stray dogs, because there'd been a football game on and they'd all flown, I must say, not driven, 3 hours to the north to play football. But it was a place of remarkable ancient beauty and kind of modern tatty settlement. But the people had a very strong spirit.
Well, why don't we listen to Warrakoona? That was Midnight Oil from their 1987 album Diesel and Dust. And they have a new album out called Earth and Sun and Moon. And Midnight Oil's lead singer, Peter Garrett, is here today. How do you work out politics within the band? It seems to me that there's so many group decisions that you have to make, from, you know, what benefits you're going to play and what issues you're going to get involved in and how you conduct your business and what stand you take in your song lyrics. Like, do you make all these decisions through consensus, and how do you do that? Do you have long meetings?
Legendarily long meetings, it must be said. We've met for weekends without pause.
About what? Like, give me an example of something that took a whole weekend to decide.
To agonize over? Let me think.
Song lyrics?
No, we certainly wouldn't committee on song lyrics. But, I mean, we've had longer arguments about tempos than we have had about words. Do you know what I mean?
Right. What have you figured out about how to put a message in a song but not turn people off who don't want to be preached at?
Well, I haven't figured anything out about it because one of my nicknames in Midnight Oil is The Preacher. I'm cautioning everybody to be careful here. I don't accept the view that you turn people off with slogans. I've yet to see any evidence of it, but everybody seems to feel that way. I think that's just part of the prevalent semi-liberal, semi-repressive wimpy way in which we all conduct our public and our private lives in the 80s and the 90s. But we don't actually sit down, and I must repeat it, we don't actually sit down and figure out how to get the message out. In fact, the message is very much emblematic or symbolic. It's not actually the raison d'etre. We have to be able to come up with a primal rhythm, usually in 4-4. We have to come up with chords, and we have to come up with an emotional response to something. It might be described in political language without getting into semiotics. That's what happens when you have graduates writing pop songs. I mean, we really ought to be grunting and doing and RRRing, but we've just gotten to the point in language where we probably do a little more than that.
You were just finishing up your law degree when you saw an ad for a band looking for a singer. What possessed you to answer that ad?
I was desperate. I couldn't get a job. I was working on building sites, and I thought I might be able to go surfing during the day.
Now, I read an article in Musician Magazine that said that you didn't really know how to sing when you first joined the band.
There's no argument about that at all.
Well, how did you learn how to sing?
Well, I didn't really. I just closed my eyes and, you know, opened it up and let it happen. And I'm still trying to work on it, you know.
Did you sound a lot different back then than you do now?
Yeah, I sounded absolutely awful. Kind of this nasally, whiny, kind of high-pitched voice sort of squawking, you know, in between the guitars and occasionally spitting out a bit of polemic. It wasn't all, I'm amazed 5,000 people bought the first record, you know.
When you perform, you're one of the most energetic frontmen of any band. In fact, I read that you can't use a wireless mic because you dance so hard you shatter the transistor crystals in it. Is that true?
You've been talking to my crew. They won't let me use one.
Well, a friend of mine, he saw you recently, and he said he got exhausted just watching you.
Uh-huh.
And he was wondering if it really takes a toll on you.
Physically?
Yeah.
To a point, I suppose it does. I mean, it's not something that I think about much. An Oils performance is a very absolute, full immersion. You know, there's no doubt about that. And I do really strain every fiber to get the thing working to a level that I feel happy about. Quite often they're pushing me a little hard too, and that's good. And we've had oxygen at shows and smashed things up, and I've been carried off now and then. But
did you say you've had oxygen at shows?
Yeah.
For you?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, we've just come from Brazil, and we had to have it there. But that's not because I've mindlessly kind of lost control and just, you know, gone into sort of marathon mode. I think it's just that I'm just pretending that I'm 17 and I'm not, you know.
Well, you're in your late 30s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How much longer do you think you can do that?
6 or 8 months. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's a really interesting question for all of us, you know, how long can you go? And I mean, I feel marvelous, you know, I feel really superbly healthy. I'm very blessed to have good health and good constitution. And so long as I can feel the kick drum, you know, belting me in the back, I seem to be okay.
Why don't we take a short break? We'll be back in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. Peter Garrett of the band Midnight Oil is my guest. You actually ran for the Senate in Australia, and you almost won.
Yes.
Why did you run?
Oh, well, I ran because I was asked. We had a situation in the country in the mid-80s where people were very concerned about the build-up of nuclear armaments, the visits of nuclear-powered ships and submarines, testing at Muroa by the French, testing, above ground testing by the Chinese, and a fledgling anti-nuclear party sort of flowered very quickly in the various states, and various people stood, and I was a Senate candidate, I beg your pardon, in New South Wales, which is where the city of Sydney is. And, I mean, it was an interesting experience. We had a lot of artists, writers, kids involved, and even though the structure of the thing was quite flawed and, you know, delightfully amateurish, the sorts of principles and the things that we were talking about, we were able to get. It was a very boring election, so we got quite a lot of media. We had some radio ads, which some friends put together from an advertising. In fact, Peter Carey, the Australian novelist, who has worked and lived in the United States, is an old friend, and he came in and wrote some slogans and some advertising copy for us. And it was just a real communal thing of people just getting together and. I won't say it was altogether a party, but just enjoying themselves and throwing stuff out into the system to see what would happen. And I concentrated my fire on the foreign minister and just went after him, you know, like a tiger dog or a cattle dog, and wouldn't let go of his heel until eventually we got to have the big head-to-head on telly and, you know, call him out on some of these issues.
What would have happened if you had won? Had you ever thought the whole thing through?
We'd thought it through to an extent. I had a couple of pet philosophologists.
What did you say?
I had a couple of pet political scientists who had basically said to me that worked the Senate system through to me. And it's a preferential system, and it's too complicated even to describe on your radio station for thinking people. But in effect, what happened was the Democrats and the Republicans, i.e. the Labor and the Liberal Party in Australia, gave their preferences to one another, which is something they normally don't do. Normally they give them to everybody else except each other. But in this occasion, they gave them to one another directly, which had the effect of derailing all my votes. It's quite complicated. Legal, it was quite technically legal. And even though I got a very high popular vote, the effect of their giving one another each other's preferences was to prevent me from taking a seat in the Senate and doing me a favour, by the way, which I thought would happen. I was advised it would happen, and I was glad it happened.
I mean, had you thought, what if you had won? Would you have quit the band? Like, what would you have had to do?
I wouldn't have quit the band at all. Otherwise, I would have gone insane. And I think I just would have been a rogue senator for 3 years until they booted me out, you know.
Well, I'd like to end with Drums of Heaven, which is off the new album. Is there anything you'd like to say about this song?
It's just an interesting meander through semi-apocalyptic imagery and swirling acoustic and electric guitars, ending up with Midnight Oil sort of, you know, bouncing from planet to planet in a rock song.
Well, let's listen to it. And thanks a lot for coming by and doing the interview today.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
By the time the holy anthem is falling from her, and tears crocodile water sung, by the time you make up your mind, if ever you do, I hear the drums of heaven too.
Peter Garrett is the lead singer of the Australian band Midnight Oil. He spoke to Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. The Oil's new album is called Earth and Sun and Moon. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. was dedicated today. What do you have on that?
Eric Weiner will report on that. President Clinton made a speech, and there were other ceremonies. The phrase never again is once again being raised as a banner in memory of the Holocaust. I'll talk with a British historian, though, who maintains that the Allies during the Second World War did make a valiant effort to stop the killings in the Nazi camps. He says the only real way to accomplish that was the destruction of the German war machine. Also, we'll talk with lesbian and gay military personnel, active duty and retired, in San Antonio, Texas, about the issue of lifting the ban against homosexuals in the military, and letters from listeners, among other things. What should Bailey White really look like?
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Michael Caton-Jones comes from a hardscrabble neighborhood in Glasgow, but his first movie, Scandal, was about naughty doings among the British upper crust, specifically the Christine Keeler affair. Caton-Jones went on to direct Memphis Belle and Doc Hollywood before turning to a more personal project, Robert Getchell's new adaptation of the Tobias Wolff memoir, This Boy's Life. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
The setting is the Great American West in the year 1957. Eisenhower's president, World War II is an increasingly distant memory. And when we meet Caroline Wolfe, played by Ellen Barkin, she seems the very embodiment of American optimism, streaking across Monument Valley in her reluctant Nash, singing Sinatra songs, escaping. That's what she's done all her life, escaped from men, from jobs, from everything that threatened to pen her in. With her is her son Tobias, played by the remarkable Leonardo DiCaprio. Tobias is a smart kid, but he has a defiant streak nearly as wide as his mom's. The screenwriter Robert Getchell has investigated this mother-son terrain before, most notably in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And working with Tobias Wolff's superb book, he once again gets all the rhythms and nuances right. The mutual support systems between mother and son, the sexual resentment, the fondness, and the tension. Gradually, we watch Caroline run out of choices. And when she does, she and Tobias find themselves in Seattle, with Tobias hanging out with a bad crowd and spinning out of control.
So, what do we do?
What do you mean?
I mean, what shall we do? Because this isn't working. We barely have any money. Kathy's moving out now. And on top of it all, you've gone wild. You lie.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do. You're smoking cigarettes. You're stealing from Marion's purse. I can't handle it anymore, and it scares me. I don't know what to do. So you tell me.
I can be better. And I will be.
But Caroline knows he can't do it alone. And now she places all her hopes on a new suitor, Dwight, played by Robert De Niro. Tobias can't stand him from the moment they meet.
So you're Toby?
No.
You're not Toby?
No. Oh, he wants to be called Jack. It's silly, but you know, since he read those Jack London books, you know.
Well, I'll call him anything he wants. I always say people can call me anything they want as long as they don't call me late for supper.
It's been a very long time since Robert De Niro has given a first-rate performance. And I'm afraid his slump isn't over. Dwight turns out to be not only dorky, but downright vicious, a hard-drinking martinet who resents Caroline's love of her son and takes it out on the boy in ways that are increasingly baroque and frightening. Underplayed, Dwight might have been a haunting character, but De Niro overplays to the hilt. And worse, he condescends to Dwight. You can see how much he despises the very character he's portraying. When Caroline marries Dwight, she and Tobias move to his cabin in the appropriately named town of Concrete, Washington. And the movie becomes a battle of wills between Tobias and his new stepfather, who insists that his bullying is all for Tobias's own good. The movie's most brilliant stroke is that Dwight isn't entirely wrong. As ghastly as he is, he's teaching necessary lessons. Without them, Tobias would drift into delinquency and worse, and he knows it. In fact, what sets this boy's life apart from a dozen other coming-of-age movies is the depth of its understanding. Inch by inch, it records Tobias's progress along the tightrope between rebellion and discipline. Nothing director Michael Caton Jones has ever done could have prepared you for the sensitivity and mastery of tone he shows here. And though he's worked with young actors before, he's never directed a performance as good as this one by Leonardo DiCaprio. DiCaprio's a real find. He conveys all the emotional churning beneath Tobias's surly cool without a hint of falseness or sentimentality. A movie about the travails of adolescence may sound like familiar territory, but this boy's life feels completely, surprisingly fresh. Certainly, it's the finest American movie we've seen so far this year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, with the Middle East peace talks scheduled to resume next week in Washington, we'll talk about Israeli and Palestinian human rights issues with Andrew Whitley, director of the human rights group Middle East Watch. Also, journalist Randy Schiltz discusses his new book, Conduct Unbecoming, A History of Gays in the Military. That's all coming up on the next Fresh Air.